is 2:06, and I want to call this House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Present with us today are Representative Mellett, Representative Klayman, Representative Lynn, Vice Chair Keller, and myself, Chair Ledoux. To begin with, could you please, everybody, silence your cell phone devices. We have three bills before us today. The previously heard HB 123, the governor's bill to establish a marijuana control board, and two new bills. HJR 14 calls for U.S. Counterman Convention, and HCR 4 U.S. Counterman Convention delegates, both sponsored by Representative Shelley Hughes. I am hoping that we can move all three bills today. Before I go any further, I'd like to note that Representative Grunberg has now joined us. So first up, for its, I think, third performance in front of this committee, is HB 123. And we have again Michaela Fowler of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. And we have Cynthia Franklin of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. And I think there is also Harriet Milks here, Assistant Attorney General, available for questions as well. We have a new CS for this bill. May I have a motion to adopt version 29-GH1110/P?
Madam Chair, I move 123/P as a working document.
Thank you very much. Hearing no objection, version P is before the committee. To begin with, Ms. Fowler, please put yourself on the record and brief the committee on HB 123, version P.
Members of the committee, my name is Michaela Fowler. I am the legislative liaison for the Department of Commerce. There are two changes in this new version of HB 123 responsive to concerns that were voiced in the last hearing. The first change, if you turn to page two,
Eddie's. On record, we've at least somewhat solved the problem. Ms. Fowler, please proceed.
If you would turn to page 2, line 17, the word currently has been added to the rural seat. It is now required that one person currently residing in a rural area be serving on the board. The second change relates to the same topic, and that is on page 3, line 19. And the definition of rural has been changed to mean rural area means a community with a population of 7,000 or less that is not connected by road or rail to Anchorage or Fairbanks, or with a population of 2,000 or less that is connected by road or rail to Anchorage or Fairbanks. This is a new definition for rural, but it is closely related to a sort of combination of other definitions of rural that are in existing statute. The final change is on page 4, and it's line 16, and it is removing the word possession, or 15, I apologize. Page 4, line 15, removing the word possession from what the board controls. The board shall now control the cultivation, manufacture, and sale of marijuana in the state, but possession is not included in that list. Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like Representative Grunberg has a question.
Okay, I'm looking at what Representative Foster was going to offer, and if you have that, anybody, it was hit on page 2, lines 30 to 31, section 1738.080 is repealed, and then he has the repealed language there, 1738.080 sub E. I don't see there.
That's a different
and then there's no change apparently in this version repealing that statute, which it looks like Representative Foster wanted to do here. And I'm just wondering about that.
Okay, I don't have this amendment. I thought that we had incorporated Representative Foster's concerns into the CS. Is that correct, Representative Foster?
As far as I was aware.
This is, maybe we could have, could somebody, through the chair, Tom, could you get us a copy of AS 17.30, just give us title 17. We can just get the title up there, and we can just have a minute, Madam Chair.
All right, please. Question that you'd like to answer.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, in the previous version, lines 30 and 31 said that the rural member of the board shall reside or shall have resided in a rural area for no fewer than 180 days in the prior 5 years. Right. That section was removed when currently was added to section 2, line 17.
Through the chair. So that's yet another change.
Yes.
That's fine.
I think Representative Grunberg, that Ms. Bowler indicated that currently had been put into it.
No, I knew that, but I didn't know about this. I just wanted to be sure.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, so do we have any other questions for Ms. Bowler? Do we have any questions for either Cynthia Franklin or Harriet Milks? Okay, then thank you very much. Committee discussion. I think we may have one proposed amendment on this bill. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hereby move the amendment number one.
And I'm going to object to that. Please present your amendment and the reasons for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment proposes that a marijuana establishment may not be registered under this chapter if a person has been was an owner, officer, agent, or employee of a marijuana establishment, and he or she has been convicted of a felony, and less than 5 years have elapsed since the person's unconditional discharge from the conviction, or a misdemeanor involving a controlled substance within the last 3 years. Such convictions, felonies, or misdemeanors involving a controlled substance, which could be marijuana, has demonstrated a predilection not to follow established law. It's a state of mind, and I think that the past is too often the predictor of the future, and I think we must be very, very cautious. We're breaking new ground in every aspect of marijuana laws, and we must be exceedingly cautious on how we do this, and there should be, and I think are many, many people out there who would not be concerned about this because they've never been convicted of such crimes. And I think it's a cautionary thing. I think it's a good thing, and I urge your approval of the amendment.
What I'd like to do is I would like to ask Ms. Franklin and Ms. Fowler and maybe Ms. Milks to come up here and explain how this might be done and what their view of this amendment is, and perhaps how things are done with respect to the alcohol industry.
Good afternoon. My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Thank you for having me and for your question, Madam Chair. With regard to alcohol in Title IV, we have essentially a longer look back on felonies, but no outright prohibition on individuals with felony convictions being licensed for purposes of operating or holding a liquor license. So we have a 10-year look back period. If the person applying for a license has been convicted within the past 10 years of a felony, they must come to the board and explain the conviction, and then the board has the discretion to grant the license in spite of the conviction or to deny the license on the basis of the conviction. So it's a bit more open than Representative Lynn's amendment, but it is a different substance, and alcohol has not recently been in the Controlled Substances Act, and in fact, marijuana may remain in the Controlled Substances Act, depending on the fate of bills in the legislature. So I certainly see the difference. Frankly, a clear prohibition will decrease board time spent on this issue, but I would imagine that individuals who plan to apply for licenses might have more to say about it than I do in terms of their opinion on it.
Okay, and Ms. Franklin, is there anything in the with respect to misdemeanors in the ABC board?
Madam Chair, no.
Okay, and I guess I'd also like to know whether or not the look back provision with respect to felonies, is that in the statute or is that in regulations?
It's in regulation, Madam Chair.
It is in regulations. Yes. Well, I am going to probably suggest, I mean, my view of this is that if this is something that is done in a regulation with respect to the alcohol industry, I'd kind of like to keep it pretty much the same way with respect to this industry. So I am not going to withdraw my objection, but when the, hopefully, this passes out of committee and there is a marijuana control board, then this certainly is an issue which can be considered in the regulations, whether to have it a 5-year, whether to have it a 10-year, and whether or not to include misdemeanors.
Madam Chair, I should have added as well that there is a prohibition similar to Representative Lynn's in Senate Bill 62. I can't recall whether or not that bill contains a prohibition on related to misdemeanor convictions, but certainly the 5-year felony prohibition is present in the current version of Senate Bill 62.
Thank you. Representative Klayman.
I just want to make sure, because I broadly agree with the chair with regard to let's do this as a regulatory matter and not as a statutory matter, but is the condition of HB 123 adequate to give the what would be the Marijuana Control Board regulatory authority to create that same deal as that the Alcohol Board has, or do we need some change to 123 if we want to make sure that the Marijuana Control Board has that authority?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, the language is adequate.
Thank you. Then I too will share in the objection of the chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Keller.
You mentioned, Cindy, that the time saved for the board by having these parameters, that would imply that the 10-year look-back period that is there takes a considerable amount of time. Have you had to make decisions that were controversial in this in your look-back experience in the past?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I've only been to three board meetings. We did have an applicant with a felony conviction come up at one of those board meetings. I wouldn't say it takes a significant amount of time. It does involve the board going into executive session because an individual's criminal history is private. And so typically speaking, because we discover those criminal convictions through the APSIN security clearance that our enforcement officers have and the authority that we have to look at an individual's criminal history who applies for a license, we go into executive session at the board meeting for the board to discuss that history with the applicant. And I would not say that it takes a significant amount of time. I do believe that it adds a human element to the board process. In the particular case that I observed, it allowed the board to consider rehabilitation efforts that the individual had made. It was a controlled substance conviction. It was a very long time before, and that individual had circumstances that she wanted to explain to the board, and the license that she was applying for was a beer and wine license at a kind of a sort of a hamburger wings joint. So, you know, the board was able to consider the age of the conviction, the type of license applied for, and weigh those various determinations, as opposed to a scheme where the simple fact of the conviction would automatically preempt the person from holding such a license. So I do think it adds a human element to the board process. I don't think it's a tremendous amount of time, but certainly a brighter line when it's an out-and-out prohibition.
So Ms. Franklin, I
have a follow-up first.
Oh, go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add just on that I think 5 years and 3 years is very reasonable, and we are comparing 5 years to 10 years is not apples to apples. I just think it's a very good amendment, and I'm on board.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. I just would like to say one thing. When the chair mentioned some things that might be issues for the regulatory authority to consider, I don't want the record to be reflective that those would be the only issues. I think other issues might be whether the person would have a right to appear before the board. And some other things could be, I mean, somebody might have had a little marijuana in a baggie in their car glove compartment and have been charged within the last 3 years, whether that sort of thing should disqualify. And also whether this activity may have occurred in a different jurisdiction with different laws. And so I agree with the regulatory, you know, taking it to the regulatory authority, but I didn't want the record to think that we have come up with all the issues here.
Thank you.
Could I respond to Representative Greenberg?
Sure, go right ahead.
You said possibility somebody could have had a little bag of small amount of marijuana in the car, which prior to this initiative would have been illegal, but it still showed a predilection to not obey the law as it was. That was the law then. Since initiative passed, we're going to have a new law on this, but we should obey the laws of the day.
Just that depends upon the case. I'm not getting into that.
That's okay.
I don't want to.
Okay. I've got a question, Ms. Franklin. In the alcohol context, is the prohibition applied to simple employees of the bar, or is it just somebody who gets the license?
Madam Chair, applicant for the license or applicant for the transfer.
So it wouldn't affect if you're hiring somebody and they're going to have a TAM card, for example.
Madam Chair, correct.
Thank you. Representative Klayman.
I just want to note one of the challenges and why I just a further note in support of the regulatory approach as opposed to the statutory approach. One of the things we are actually trying to do as one of the many in this body who voted no on the initiative but recognized the will of the voters and trying to follow that part of the challenge is that we actually want people who now may be in the
marijuana growing business to actually register and participate in that. And so I think one of the challenges that we presented with, even though somebody may have in fact been violating the law 3 years ago and has a misdemeanor conviction for marijuana possession, I would rather have that person registering and being licensed and identified as we go forward. And I think the Marijuana Control Board is the agency that would be in the best position to sort of manage those individuals on an individual basis, because frankly, I'd rather have them registered and knowing who they are than have them in the black market, which is part of what we're trying to work against.
Any other discussion?
I just had one, you, if I may.
Yes, go right.
You indicated that you're going to executive session because conventions are private. Are they really private? Can't anybody go on the internet and find out, or go down to the courthouse and find out if somebody's convicted of anything?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, it depends if it's an Alaska conviction. If it's an Alaska conviction and it's in court view, then anyone can see it. If it's a federal conviction or an out-of-state conviction that we locate on that criminal history record that we run, then it is not viewable by the public. But the board is governed by processes created in regulation in terms of how to treat the criminal history at their public meetings. And so the applicant applies, the absent history is run, and if there's an item on the history that would cause the applicant to fall under that regulation, then that information is shared solely with the director and then with the board in executive session versus being on our public agenda, being posted up to our website, because the board actually reviews that information as presented by someone with absent clearance.
Okay. I don't want to explore that anymore, but again, we're entering an entirely new ground here with this bill. We're all trying to do our best, and I think if we err, it ought to be on the side of caution. And I think, again, instead of 5 years for felony, it could have been 10, 20, you know, whatever. We were trying to reach a reasonable compromise here. And the same with a misdemeanor. It could have been any number of years. We chose 3 years as a reasonable thing for controlled substances only, not for any other misdemeanor, of which there are many, many kinds. But this shows a predilection to disobey marijuana laws as they existed before the initiative. And I think it just makes sense to be erring on the side of caution and to put these restrictions in. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Representative Lynn. Do we have any further discussion? Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
Yes. Representative Groenberg?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Keller?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Millett?
No.
Representative Klayman?
No.
Representative Ledoux?
No.
2 in favor, 5 against.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any further discussion on this bill? I actually have one more question for Ms. Franklin. Does this bill give the board the authority to create whatever license or sublicense types it deems necessary in order to effectively regulate the industry?
Madam Chair, yes, I believe it does.
Thank you very much. Representative Groenberg?
Yeah, we, in the UCMJ discussion last week, we were concerned, some of us, about whether that agency, that department, would have the authority to create crimes. And here we have a different agency, but the same question. Will the Marijuana Board have the authority to create crimes?
Representative Groenberg, through the chair, I believe the answer to that question is no, that by regulation we won't be creating crimes. I do think that through regulation, if criminal activity is identified, there can be some penalty work done by regulation, but in terms of creating crimes, jailable offenses, the answer would be no. Obviously, 1738 gives whichever regulatory board has authority over this substance the ability to create civil penalty fines related to violation of the rules created by the board.
If I may follow up, please.
Go right ahead.
You said, and I don't remember your exact words, but something to the effect that the board may be able to do something with respect to penalties, criminal penalties. Did I hear that right?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that's based on a discussion pre-session with our attorneys in terms of how far the regulations might go if no amendments to 1738 were had. I would want to refresh my memory on that before I can put myself on the record. Because generally speaking, and particularly with regard to Title IV, our regulations clarify statutes rather than creating. I know that we cannot create crimes.
I don't know whether that would cause an issue in my mind. You don't know at this point, and this is a House bill. And it's great, you want to move it out today. I guess what we could do, if it's okay with you, Madam Chair, would be to ask a written follow-up answer to my question that could be delivered to the chair and to the committee, and then we could see if there's a problem and let somebody down the line know if there is.
And there is somebody down the line, Representative Grunberg.
Would that be agreeable with the chair?
That would be fine.
Would you be willing to do that?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, yes.
Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Ms. Franklin. Thank you, Ms. Fowler. Can I have a motion to move this bill?
Madam Chair, I move CSHB 123, Judiciary Version GH1110P, out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes, plural.
I'm not laughing at you, I'm laughing at
her. Seeing no objection, the bill passes from committee, and we'll have a brief at ease to sign.
Back to pot.
No, we're not back to pot. We are on another subject right now.
Any of the pot bills we could hear today?
Can't we hear more pot?
Don't worry.
Are you
going
to say this legislature is going to pot?
Okay. We are now at H.J.R. 14, and we have the bill sponsor, Representative Hughes, here to present. Please put yourself on the record and brief the committee on H.J.R. 14.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Shelley Hughes. I'm representative for District 11 Palmer, and I have my staff, Stuart Kruger, here with me. And I suppose this could, in a way, be related to pot if we decide we'd want to overturn something at the federal level, because that is somewhat what this is about. And before I start, I'd like to ask the chair if I'd have permission. We have two pieces of legislation that are in tandem, and we have the HCR 4 and then the HJR 14, and they really work as a pair. And with your permission, Madam Chair, we'd like to be able to talk about them together. I think that'd be easiest to be repetitive otherwise.
I think that is an excellent idea.
Okay, thank you.
Views.
And I'd first like to draw your attention. Back in the corner on the wall is posted Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. And I'm just going to read just a line of that, because we hear about Article 5 efforts, but just make sure we all know what that is. In our U.S. Constitution, Article 5, part of it reads, "The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution," or, and this is the part to pay attention to, because it's what we're going to talk about today, "or on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution, when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by convention in three-fourths thereof." as one of the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress. And so that's what this is about. This is an Article 5 effort, and I think probably the easiest way to sum up what this is all about is understanding the word countermand means veto. And so this would give states, legislatures across the United States, veto power over certain decisions that are being decided upon in D.C. if a certain number of states agree. The two pieces of legislation, one is the call to the Congress, and that is H.J.R. 14. That's the thinner, fewer page resolution. And then the second one is H.C.R. 4, which gives the delegate instructions and contains the actual language that we would be, if this whole process would continue, would be added at the bottom of the Constitution, which right now would be Article 28 if it were to be amended. And so the way it works, there's a bit of a math involved too, so I'll just go through this quickly for those of you who aren't familiar with it. The way Article 5, because there's fractions and numbers of states involved, to call a convention, it requires two-thirds of the states. Two-thirds of 50 is 34. So you got 34 states to call it. And then to ratify an amendment, it takes three-fourths of the 50, and that number, magic number, is 38. So 34 to call it, 38 to ratify an amendment. Now, there's another amendment that is involved in actually just in this countermand amendment, because this countermand amendment is actually a mechanism to give the states veto power over decisions, federal decisions. And for that, it is a three-fifths fraction, three-fifths of the 50 states, or 30 states. So we have 34 to call the convention, 38 to ratify the amendment, and then the amendment itself requires 30 to veto a federal decision. So I just thought those numbers are just kind of all over the place, so I just thought I'd lay that out. Now, I don't need to tell any of you about the problems we here in Alaska have had with federal overreach. In fact, in my short time as a legislator, I've been surprised how often on the House floor we pass a resolution with the theme of overreach. And those are very important statements that we make. But when we all stop and think about it, what have they actually moved the needle to restore the balance of power that we as Alaskans feel needs to be restored? They haven't really changed much. They've been important statements. This is actually, instead of just getting up and passing a resolution, which is a statement, is actually a step. It's an actionable step in a process. It's a long process. It's an Article 5 process. We'd have a lot of other states would need to come on board in order to do this. But it is a necessary step, and I think is an important step for Alaska to take. And the founders put it in the Constitution at the time. And just a really brief history lesson, when we formed this nation, the states initially came together, and it wasn't the U.S. Constitution, it was the Articles of Confederation. As it turned out, the states retained too much power in that case, and when they came back into the U.S. Constitution, the idea was that there was the proper balance between state and federal government. But things occurred over the decades and over the centuries. One of those was the power to tax, and once the federal government held the purse strings, they gained a lot of power. That's just one example. And so now we, as Alaskans and other states, we realize the need to swing the pendulum back towards the states. So this is not a conservative or liberal, Republican or Democrat. This is really about restoring the power between the state and federal government. And so with that introduction, I am going to ask Stuart to quickly walk you through the two pieces. He'll do the call to the convention first. That's the H.J.R. 14, that's the shorter one, and then he'll do the longer resolution that puts up the sideboards establishes a delegate credential committee, which would be made up of legislators who then are the ones to work with the delegates. And so he will go through that. And I do want to say There has been a little bit of concern as these kind of efforts occur that, oh my goodness, our U.S. Constitution, it's a sacred document. We don't want to go in and mess with anything. And so they've been really concerned about opening up and having a convention. Well, this is not a constitutional convention. This is an amendment convention and a single amendment convention. And the sideboards would prevent it to be anything else in on any other topic. So we believe that it would protect us and safeguard us as far as we wouldn't be unraveling the Constitution. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll let Stewart walk us through the two documents.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stewart Krueger, staff to Representative Shelley Hughes. So I can be short and sweet with HJR 14. Essentially what this is the State of Alaska's call on Congress for an amendment convention for the sole purpose of sending the Counterman Amendment back to the states for ratification. The first resolve simply states that, and the focus is to keep it at a single issue amendment convention. The second resolve states that the United States Congress will convene a convention upon the 34th application within 60 days. The third resolve just states that this is a continuing application and that that will remain with Congress until that 34th application is received. The next resolve just encourages the legislatures of the other 49 states to pass a similar resolution. And then there's who the copies of this resolution will be sent to. And for HCR 4, a little bit more of a meaty document, but resolve number one authorizes the legislature to appoint and summon delegates, and this is starting on page 2, line 26, authorizes the legislature to appoint and summon delegates for the amendment convention. Resolve 2, page 2, line 29, gives the legislature authority to decide the qualifications and total number of delegates to send to the convention. Resolve 3, page 3, line 1, gives the legislature the ability to add and remove delegates. Resolve 4, page 3, line 6, provides parameters and instructions for the state's delegates at the convention, also prohibits delegates from voting for any other amendment outside the Counterman Amendment at the convention. Resolve 5, on page 3, line 13, reserves the Counterman Amendment as the only amendment for consideration for ratification by the legislatures. Resolve 6, page 3, line 15, upon a call for convention by 34 states, this resolve allows for establishing of the Delegate Credential Committee within the Alaska Legislature with duties listed in Section A later in this document. A little bit more specific about the Credential Committee is that the Speaker of the House shall appoint 3 members from the House, one being a minority caucus member, and the President of the Senate shall appoint 3 members of the Senate, one being a minority member. Resolve 7 on page 3, line 24, provides for the replacement procedure for members of the Delegate Credential Committee. Resolve 8 on page 3, line 26, allows for selection of co-chairs of the Delegate Credential Committee, one being from the House and one being from the Senate. Resolve 9 on page 3, line 30, establishes when the Delegate Credential Committee can meet. Resolve 10, page 4, line 1, acknowledges that the Delegate Credential Committee will continue until the first day of the 30th Alaska State Legislature and also requests that it be reevaluated by subsequent legislatures. Resolve 11, page 4, line 3, requests that the Delegate Credential Committee be considered for reestablishment during the 30th Alaska State Legislature. Resolve 12, page 4, line 6, provides for removal and replacement procedure for members of the Delegate Credential Committee. Members are removed or replaced by the presiding officer that appointed them. Resolve 13, Section A, page 4, line 17, provides for the duties of the Delegate Credential Committee. And this is a majority vote on decisions, official facilitator for the legislature, appointment of delegates, provide a committee report on selected delegates, appointing chair and assistant chair of the delegation, properly vet and confirm delegates, issue convention passes to delegates, notify legislature of financial needs at the convention, administer oaths to the delegates, alternates, chair and assistant chair, monitor activities of Alaska's delegation, submit quarterly reports to the legislature on events, and progress and recommendations for the convention, authority to recommend removal of a delegate or alternate for approval by the legislature. Resolve 13, Section B, page 6, line 11, provides for the duties of the chair of Alaska's state delegation and the president of the convention. Chair is responsible for communicating with other state delegations to open convention for business, identifying other legislatures that have approved a delegate resolution, build consensus with at least 26 state delegations to require that each state delegation at the convention has only one vote, require a simple majority vote for all roll calls, nominate convention officials, require a quorum of 26 states to conduct business, build a consensus of at least 26 states to support sending the Counterman Amendment for ratification, work to conclude the convention in 21 days or no longer than 180 days, nominate a candidate for convention president from Alaska's delegation, or work to elect a president from a delegate resolution state. Resolve 13, Section B, Subsection J on page 7, line 31, under duties of the Alaska delegation chair includes supporting the following duties of the convention president. Convention president duties include securing a vote for this delegate resolution to be the rules of order at the convention, focus on the purpose of sending the counterman amendment for ratification by the states, request security measures as needed, oversee installment of officers at the convention, establish convention agenda, provide equal time for floor discussion for all states, to prohibit introduction of any other subject other than the counterman amendment, call for a vote for sending counterman amendment to the states, report to 50 state legislatures and the media.
Mr. Kruger, I'm wondering if you might be able to point out some of the highlights as opposed to simply reading from the...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
So overall, that would just address the duties of the president of the entire convention. So the next resolve addresses the duties and responsibilities of convention delegates. And the Resolve 13, Section D, page 11, line 1, addresses the duty and responsibilities of delegate alternates. And then Resolve 13, Section E, page 11, line 8, actually provides the text of the Counterman Amendment. And we have Mike Schechter from the Department of Law on the line for questions, as well as Charles Keperwitz from Citizens Initiatives. He's the executive director of the organization that brought this legislation to us.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Kruger or Representative Hughes? Do we have any questions for anybody from Mr. Schechter from the Department of Law? All right. Well, thank you very much, and we will now open public testimony. So it looks like we have one person on the line, and that's Charles. How do I pronounce his name again? Kasprowitz?
I believe it's Keperwitz.
Keperwitz. All right. Mr. Keperwitz, would you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for inviting me and the members of your committee. By the way, I have great trouble spelling my name, so there's no difficulty in you mispronouncing it. But it is Keperwitz. And the fact is that it is a Polish name, and it's difficult for me, so hopefully we'll not have to repeat it over and over again. I am Charles Keperwitz. I am the Executive Director for Citizen Initiatives and the Counterman Amendment. I have been working on amendments to the U.S. Constitution, either through Congress or state legislatures, under Article 5 for over 40 years. I probably have the most longevity of any Article 5 group or individual that is presently advancing Article 5 amendments. The difference that we propose is the idea that state legislatures, under Article 5, are sovereign. that they are actually the final arbiters in all constitutional matters. We are a constitutional republic. That's why we have a constitution to protect that. Article 4, Section 4 guarantees that every state is guaranteed a republican form of government. That's important to note because that means that every state has one vote. That means that regardless of the population, each state has equal standing. And that goes into the convention as well. Now, the fact is that the biggest problem that existed during the Constitutional Convention and actually before deliberations started was sovereignty. They could not settle on how they were going to vote. The bigger states wanted the vote to be based on the population of their states. The smaller states, they said, no, we want it based on one vote per state. And so they assigned a man, a delegate by the name of George Wythe. He was a notable attorney, professor, a very distinguished gentleman at the time. And he headed up a committee and put eight rules together. The most important rule of the committee was the recommendation that each state would have an equal vote. In fact, he won the day. The convention agreed, and the convention went forward from that point forward as a Republican form of convention. Not a Republican Party form of convention, but a Republican convention. And the fact is that every state had equal standing as a result, regardless of the number of delegates. Now, that issue has to be settled at every Article 5 convention. It doesn't matter what someone may like to do. We have some advocates out there for these Article 5 amendments, and they are arguing that, well, based on historical precedent or legal precedent or even convention experience before the Constitutional Convention, the delegates will be able to sort things out and decide this matter on how to vote in a gentlemanly way. Well, I'm not certain of that. As a matter of fact, there could be as many as 534 politically charged delegates going to this convention. The fact is that when the Confederation Congress had summoned delegates to the Constitutional Convention, they summoned 73. Now, there were only 13 states. So that meant they did it based on the representation that was in Congress at that time. And that's going to happen now. So now they have 534 or 35, and now the states have to decide how many of those they're going to send. They'll be allotted a number, probably according to the number of representatives they have in Congress. The outcome of that choice will be Wyoming will send 3, and California will send 55. Well, if you haven't even settled how the voting takes place before the convention starts, the Article 5 Countermand Amendment Convention starts, how in the world are you going to decide how the voting is going to take place on a Republican form of government? So the point that we have to address here is we have to make certain that sovereignty is retained by state legislatures. I don't really care the party affiliation. Sovereignty trumps legal precedent, it trumps convention experience, it trumps historical events, and it is the one thing that the legislatures must not abdicate, because if they abdicate it, they'll not get it back. Every Article 5 convention has to be protected. So instead of sending 534 politically charged delegates, all of whom have to sort out what it means to have a countermand amendment or any other kind of amendment, instead of letting them decide the matter, the legislatures are, in fact, the deliberative body. You folks are elected by your constituents. You are the deliberative body for deciding matters relating to your state, and that includes how to use Article 5. And so as the deliberative body, you make the decisions as to what these delegates do at the convention. They don't go as free agents. They should go as ambassadors under your charge. And that makes the convention safe. And as a result, the outcome of that convention will not only be successful, but it'll probably be completed in about 7 days. That's my prediction, at any rate. Now, there was a second problem.
Mr. Kaprovitz, I'm going to have to ask you to begin wrapping it up. It's getting towards the end of our committee meeting, and we've just allocated 5 minutes of testimony per person.
Okay. I thought I had a little more time than that. All right. The amendment itself is going to allow the state of Alaska to address some of the most critical issues that it has to deal with right now. Nevada has about 82% of its land controlled by the federal government. I understand Alaska has about 67%. I'm not sure of that percentage. And you just recently had a problem with the executive order that locked up more land, preventing you from using it for whatever purposes you choose. Well, the Countermand Amendment can address that. There are 38 states that are energy-producing states. With the Countermand Amendment, you need only 30 countermands. So if you decided to countermand a particular EPA ruling or BLM ruling or some other statute, and you sent it out to the federal government, the appropriate agencies, and you then sent an invitation to the other 49 states saying, we are inviting you to countermand this same law because of these reasons, you will more than likely get the 30 you need just on the issue of energy, because there are 38 energy-producing states. As a result, it will put the state legislatures in a respected role by the federal government. You will be looked at
Mr. Kaprowitz, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off. I want to leave a little bit of time if anybody has to would like to ask you a question, however.
Okay, go right ahead.
So do I have anybody who would like to ask any questions of Mr. Kaprowitz? All right. Well, thank you very, very much for your testimony. I appreciate your being here today.
All right. Thank you for inviting me, folks.
So is there anybody else online who would like to testify? Anybody here in the audience who would like to testify? Well, then I am going to close public testimony. We've got the bill before us. Is there any discussion? Representative Keller.
if you want to go first, Representative.
Sure, I can.
It doesn't matter.
I've actually spent some time speaking with Representative Hughes about this, and I think the idea of trying to make it a little bit a framework in which states could take up certain acts of Congress may have some validity, but I think this particular proposal, unless it were modified, I think probably goes too far. For example, I think that the provisions that I'm looking at page 11 of HCSHCR4, I think the provisions that would allow a popular vote or a state's vote to overturn a judicial decision, as well as the Senate action approving a treaty are both going farther than I think would be appropriate in terms of a state's role in our constitutional democracy. So while I think this is a positive idea, I think it needs refining before it's ready for prime time. So with those comments, I'm not sure I have a problem passing it on a committee, but I'm not ready to support it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Any other comments or questions? Representative Keller.
Yeah, I just want to make a very general statement that this is a very good effort. There's many of them out there. Article 5, they're very relatively very low risk to us. If you remember last year, we passed the Article 5 effort on the balanced budget amendment. Now there are four states. North Dakota just joined with Alaska, Georgia, Mississippi, and there's another half a dozen that are in the process. So it just takes time for these things to happen, and it's good. I've also been involved. I'm going somewhere. So I'll be very brief, Madam Chair. I've been involved with the Alaska Assembly, or the Assembly of State Legislators. It's a national group of legislators that are getting together and working on approximately the same thing as the countermand process, but the effort there is to try to come up with the rules and the agenda for the first convention and whatever. So the point is that there are several of these out there, and they all help us because they're raising the awareness that basically that the states have a responsibility, or the option, I guess, of using the Article 5. It was meant for us. It was intended to be used, and it's a great, great bill. And, Madam Chair, I would like to, whenever you're ready, move the bills.
Well, if there are no other comments, then Representative Keller.
I would move the CS Joint Resolution 14. That's version November. That's the application from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal amount.
Seeing no objection, that moves. So we'll take a brief at ease, and then we're going to have to do the same. Further discussion on HCR We just did 14.
Four now.
So do we have any further discussion on HCR 4?
Madam Chair, I would move concurrent with HCR 4, version M, committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objections, the bill moves. Please. 8:09, and we are adjourned until 1 p.m. tomorrow.